Hi there, Making Contact listener. Before we play our special episode all about divestment from fossil fuels, I just want to take a moment of your time. We make this show available for free to radio stations and listeners in the US and around the world, but we rely upon donations from individuals like you. So if you like what you're hearing, please go to radioproject.org, click on the big donate button, and give whatever you can. Every little bit helps. Thanks a lot.
Making contact.
Hear that? That's the sound of money pouring into the world's largest fossil fuel companies. Those are the corporations involved in oil, gas, and coal. It's a trillion-dollar industry in which the largest companies are worth billions of dollars each. As of July 2014, ExxonMobil was valued at $425 billion, Shell at $268 billion, Chevron at $246 billion. The list goes on. Environmentalists say these companies are profiting from fossil fuels at a time when we need to be cutting back on carbon emissions. But campaigners say they have hit upon a way to pull the plug on the fossil fuels industry. It's called divestment.
Fossil fuel divestment is an ask for folks to take their portfolio money, their investment money, and remove it from the top 200 fossil fuel companies by coal, oil, and gas reserve. And that's because those companies are holding fossil fuel assets that can't be burned without overheating the planet's temperature.
That's Jay Carmona, Community Divestment Campaign Manager for 350.org. Why 350, you might ask?
So 350 is the 350 parts per million is the safe level of carbon in the atmosphere. And we're at over 400 now.
She says students have been at the forefront of the divestment campaign, with several universities and colleges in the US and abroad committing to pull their investments out of fossil fuel companies.
It's a movement that's led by and started by young people. And, you know, I think that's as it should be, you know, given the fact that young folks are going to be facing, basically living in a time and in temperatures that, you know, human beings haven't lived in before and encountering a set of circumstances on our planet that, we just haven't encountered before.
It hasn't been easy, though. Just listen to this exchange between student activists and regents at the University of Colorado, a state where the oil and gas industry is a big employer.
I'm just asking if you're calling oil and gas companies unethical.
Yes.
That's clear disagreement from a lot of people that in this county, in El Paso County, and in Weld County, and in Denver County, and in the southern part of the state, their livelihoods depend on them. They're ethical people raising families and paying taxes and being good citizens.
That exchange was part of a long-running campaign by students to get their university to divest from fossil fuels. In Boulder, Colorado, reporter Hannah Lee Myers has been finding out just what it takes to get a university to divest.
An oil rig at work in Colorado. More than 40,000 oil and gas wells like this one checker the Colorado landscape, contributing nearly $30 billion to the state economy. Home to three of the largest oil fields in the country, it's safe to say that oil and gas is a big deal here. But here at the University of Colorado in Boulder, students have mixed feelings about how much money the school has invested in fossil fuels.
See Boulder like as a green school, we do all this recycling and whatnot, and we're investing in fossil fuels, so that was just really disappointing.
I mean, that's nice in theory, but I don't really think that it's, like, very economical.
Each week, members of Fossil Free CU find a room on campus to discuss the campaign. As the students enter, tossing down backpacks and arms full of books, it's clear everyone is busy, making time for the meetings between the daily demands of college life. Since 2012, Fossil Free CU has been campaigning to pull the university's money out of fossil fuel companies, like the ones pumping oil and gas just a few miles away.
And so,
I've been thinking about this since last meeting.
Soon after the campaign began, two-thirds of the student body voted in favor of divesting from fossil fuels. But the administration didn't budge.
Students
who were involved in this and saw the way that their democratic process was treated.
That's environmental studies graduate student Kelsey Cody, who sponsored the fossil fuel divestment resolution as a member of student government.
They were not happy. I mean, it really made people feel like they were lied to about what the effect of their activity would be. You know, we were basically told that, you know, coming to the negotiating table would be a waste of time because they were going to shut us down at that table, and that we weren't going to be able to have our voice.
And many students believe that one person in particular is to blame for the university's response, University President Bruce Benson.
I'm standing in front of the Benson Earth Sciences Building on the CU Boulder campus, a building funded by a $3 million donation from University President Bruce Benson and his oil and gas company, Benson Mineral Group.
But Ken McConnellog, Vice President for Communication at the University of Colorado, says the students are blaming the wrong guy.
President Benson does not direct the investments of the University of Colorado. It's not part of his job.
Instead, he says the biggest obstacle isn't Benson. It's the university's own legal requirements to maximize investment funds.
So I think what the Board of Regents did was sent them back a letter saying, it's fine to call for divestment, but I don't think it's unreasonable to say, okay, how would you suggest we do that?
Divestment activists like Petey Gantert say the university should be able to figure those things out themselves.
We understand that there's challenges in that. I do not personally feel the need to meet those because that's not something where we have expertise in.
He points out that if the university really wanted to divest, there would be plenty of help at hand.
And there's plenty of people within the CU administration that have expertise in that. I think it's worth noting that the university has divested from other things in the past, and I'm sure that they ran into very similar things then. So I personally feel like this is just their version of throwing up a blockade.
But McConnellog says that's just not the case. The regents are legally bound not to let what he calls social issues interfere with investment decisions.
I mean, the law is very clear. Social issues should not be the basis. These are some pretty high bars to clear. These are very real things that we have to address. It's not something we can wave a wand over.
Fossil Free CU says that the university's response is just a stall tactic. But they've sought out experts to advise them in the complicated world of investments anyway. One of those experts is Stephen Schuith, president and managing member of First Affirmative, a Boulder-based investment firm specializing in so-called socially responsible portfolios. He says that he's used to hearing excuses about stopping investment in fossil fuels.
So typically what you get from the managers is either we can't do that because it will hurt performance, or... And really what they're saying there is, we don't really know how to do this, and it might hurt performance. And we don't know, but we're not willing to take the risk. It's easier not to change than it is to change.
I think that he could be right.
That's CU Boulder's Senior Instructor of Finance and Faculty Director of the Master's Program in Finance and Real Estate, David Gross. He says taking money out of larger companies and investing in multiple smaller companies does represent significant risk to portfolio managers. And that's a big concern for anyone in charge of managing investments.
It's well known that small stocks have higher risk, higher standard deviations of returns, higher variability of returns than large stocks.
Armed with signs and banners, around 50 orange-clad protesters pack the Board of Regents meeting in September of 2014.
We have two individuals signed up for public comment. First, we have Simon Mustafa with Fossil Free CU.
What we bring is a broader perspective with the understanding that long-term well-being and sustainability requires not only financial considerations, but also social and environmental ones.
Many divestment campaigners, like Mustafa, look back on historic examples of the university pulling its money out of unethical investments. Whether it's divesting from apartheid in South Africa to more recent campaigns to divest from Sudan during the Darfur crisis. So why is this divestment so different? Again, Ken McConnellog.
Apartheid and genocide are two obviously very serious issues. I don't know that, you know, divesting from fossil fuels is on the same level of those.
Simone Mostafa couldn't disagree more.
We are totally disrupting the planet. We are not making the changes quickly enough that we need to keep that change from happening. So it's a matter of at which point they're gonna get on the right side.
Back at the university, the Regents meeting is wrapping up, and Representative Stephen Ludwig has some words of advice for Mostafa and the campaigners.
I encourage you to continue to look at that and do your research. A number of issues that we talked about are still concerned me. So, but again, thanks for being here and thanks for being respectful. And thanks for all the students for being here as well.
Thank you.
Many of the students felt like they'd been given the cold shoulder once again. But Simone Mostafa says the large number of students in the room delivered the intended message.
How do you think that went?
I think it went really well. I think whereas before we had one person speaking that could be seen by them as, you know, just maybe one person's opinion or a really small group of people, this really, we really wanted to deliver the message that this is a growing movement, you know, this is just the beginning of it, and we're not going away, we're only getting bigger because, you know, this problem is not going away, so we can't really stop trying to do something about it, you know.
That was Hannah Lee Myers reporting from Boulder, Colorado on the local divestment campaign by students. If you're not a student or an investment fund manager, though, you might be wondering if any of this applies to you.
Well, even folks who don't have an investment portfolio, a lot of the time they actually do. Or they're, you know, if they live in a town or are a member of a church, that town or that church, or even if they live in a, you know, a state or a province or a county, all of those institutions typically have investments somewhere.
We'll get down to the nuts and bolts of the divestment campaign after the break.
You're listening to Making Contact. To find out more, visit radioproject.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
We've been hearing about universities investing in fossil fuels, but Jay Carmona, Community Divestment Campaign Manager for 350.org, says when you start looking, investments in fossil fuels are everywhere, from city funds to pensions. So how does someone even find out if they have investments in fossil fuel companies?
Well, as most folks know, the financial industry is not the most transparent thing. So sometimes it can be a little bit tricky. So if it's not a portfolio that you're managing or that you're holding directly, so not an individual portfolio, the easiest thing to do and a good starting place is just to go look at the organization's quarterly or yearly financial statements. Now, that won't give you the whole picture, but usually you'll be able to see the top 10 or 15 investments in a portfolio, just finding that. And this is just a general financial statement. And usually in those top 10 or 15, you'll see, you know, your Exxon or your BP or your Shell stock, or maybe even your Gazprom stock right there at the top, since it's usually one of the biggest chunks. And then from there, you can assume, you know, whatever's left of about, you know, probably about 10%, hopefully less, but, you know, up to about 10 or 15% of the portfolio is also in this list of the top 200 that we have for potentially folks can also cross-reference that if you can get a fuller list of all of the money and where it's allocated.
Given the size of the fossil fuel industry, is it really possible to pool all investments connected with oil, gas, or coal?
Well, you know, that's why we think we want to think about these top 200 companies, right? And what sets these top two companies apart is that they're essentially the companies that are sitting on the bulk of the reserves that have to stay underground. And as part of that, you know, the valuation of these companies is tied up in those reserves. So if they can't sell them, if indeed they need to leave 2/3 of the assets underground, not only will they have to do that, but it would also make their companies essentially worthless, right? So we're looking at a specific industry that's primarily valued essentially on, you know, wrecking the planet. And that's the key piece here. So it's important to distinguish these 200 companies that we're talking about from, say, you know, in industries that can actually be transitioned and that should be transitioned and that, you know, have a part to play in creating that future.
As we heard from Colorado earlier in this show, some investors are worried about pulling their investments out of fossil fuel companies because it will cost them money. What's your response to that?
you know, one of the issues that we deal with is that folks think of, you know, particularly oil, and they sort of have this, you know, idea that oil is always associated with profit, right? You know, it's the black gold sort of aspect. They think it automatically means money. And the way that the economy is looking and the way that the industry is looking is that that's just not true. And the other piece is that, you know, fossil fuels are about, like I said, 10% of the market. And if you look at, you know, any portfolio can essentially do without that 10% of the market. And the fact is that, you know, the market's huge. There are a lot of investment opportunities. And in fact, you can even still invest in the energy sector, going beyond fossil fuels. And also industries that are, you know, performing better or performing more consistently than the fossil fuel industry. And you can invest in those instead. For example, a great example is the brewing industry, which, you know, performs very comparably to, say, oil, gas, midstream. And you can actually invest in those things and rebalance your portfolio in such a way that there are no fossil fuels.
So the message is divest from oil and gas, invest in beer.
You said it, not me.
How successful has the divestment movement been both in the U.S. and abroad?
Well, so far, there's been about $50 billion divested. That's billion with a B, from about over 180 institutions. And I think we're up to about more than 400 individuals just that have been reported have divested their funds, all amounting to over $50 billion. And so it's been very, very promising so far.
Up next, we're going to hear about oil and gas companies' involvement in soccer. That may surprise some people. Have you been surprised by some of the institutions that have ties to the fossil fuel industry?
Oh, I swear someone surprised about a holding emails me almost every day. You know, and it's particularly in, you know, more progressive cities, folks have been very surprised. And like I mentioned, you know, foundations. And, you know, like I mentioned, we're all kind of in the same boat here. You know, unless we try and we actually implement those screens and think about these things, that investment money is going to be in there. And it's going to be creating a political stance in your portfolio that, you know, maybe doesn't make sense for you, maybe doesn't make sense for the future of the planet either. But, you know, like I said, foundations that do, you know, environmental work, in particular, I think is a big piece. Folks have found, you know, faith institutions that are otherwise pretty progressive and care about the planet have noted fossil fuel investments, and many of them have also divested those investments. And, you know, the faith divestment movement is incredibly strong, incredibly powerful.
So for our final story, producer and soccer fan Alex Lewis has been digging into the ties between some of the world's largest oil and gas companies and the sport he loves.
It could be away here. Michael Owen, he's got goals with him, but it's still Owen. Oh, what a goal!
My parents took me to see the World Cup in France when I was 10 years old. And it was like nothing I had ever experienced. It seemed like everyone was together, crowded around TVs, cheering on their country's team. The passion and energy of that experience was exhilarating. I followed international soccer ever since then.
England caught out, and that's a tremendous equalizer for Argentina. Wonderful craft in the free kick, and it's Zanetti, it's 2-2, and what a first half this has been.
But lately, many years later, I've started to notice other things when I watch the sport. I mean, anytime you turn on a soccer match, you can't miss the barrage of brand names, from McDonald's to UNICEF. The logos of companies and organizations are inscribed on the front and backs of every player's jersey. Ben Ayliffe, a lifelong fan of English Premier League team Arsenal, pretty much sums up the view of most soccer fans I've met.
We are quite, you know, a tribal bunch in that we don't really care about what happens so long as our team's winning and, you know, we're playing decent football. People don't actually think too much about who they're sponsored, you know, how their club operates.
But Ayliffe, who heads Greenpeace's Arctic campaign, says we should pay more attention, especially when those companies happen to be the largest oil and gas producers in the world. He says the companies use soccer to get their brands recognized.
I think there's a secondary reason as well, which is slightly more sinister, and that is to almost to detoxify the brand. And if you look at oil companies around the world, what they need to be able to drill in places like, you know, be it the tar sands in Canada, in Nigeria, in the Middle East, or even the Arctic, is a social license to operate. That is, the acceptance of people that live near where they drill or are from, you know, the countries that they're based in.
Oil companies have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in soccer sponsorships. And when a company invests in a soccer team, or even an entire league, there's more than advertising opportunities at play.
Basically like a really expensive yacht, or Porsche, or whatever.
That's Michael Goodman, sports writer for Grantland.
Some people want to do that for the prestige, and then some people want to do that to have a foothold and publicity for more global reasons. That's sort of what you've seen happening in the last decade or so.
When you're talking about oil and gas sponsorships in soccer, one company in particular stands out.
Gazprom is a company that came out of the old state-owned gas monopoly in the Soviet Union. And in the breakup of the Soviet Union in the early 90s, it became a private corporation.
That's Stefan Szymanski, professor of sports management and business at the University of Michigan. Gazprom is the largest supplier of natural gas in the world. The company had a reported income of well over $100 billion in 2013. And since the mid-90s, they've invested heavily in professional soccer. If you're in the US, you won't see this commercial. But if you watch the UEFA Champions League on a TV in Europe, you'll see this playful animated advertisement over and over again. A melody from Russian composer Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky accompanies a series of pastel scenes. They take you on a journey from a Gazprom office in the snowy countryside to the bright lights of a big city, to a stadium filled with cheering fans. This whole beautiful world, of course, is made possible by Gazprom. No one from Gazprom responded to emails and phone calls requesting an interview. But Professor Szymanski says soccer is a key part of the business plan for oil and gas companies like Gazprom.
There's a whole strategy surrounding their presence in soccer and saying, we're an international company dedicated to peace and friendship around the world, and we are using our sponsorship of soccer in order to do good in the world. So it's very much about portraying an image of them as a friendly and positive force in the world.
In its short history, Gazprom has played more than a small role in European soccer. The company was founded in 1989.
And it really got into sports and soccer sponsorship really at the end of the 90s when it was first involved with Zenit St. Petersburg.
Zenit St. Petersburg is one of the oldest pro soccer teams in Russia. Since becoming involved with the team in 1999, Gazprom has poured hundreds of millions of dollars into the soccer club,
which through its sponsorship and subsequently ownership, it's turned into really the dominant club in Russia today, and won them UEFA titles and really brought them to attention of the world.
The Tramps, as they are known to their fans, brought the Gazprom brand to a wider European audience. The company's name is emblazoned across their shirts, and they even play in what's called the Gazprom Arena. For the company, that domestic investment turned out to be just the start of a major foray into soccer sponsorship.
Gazprom ist der Hauptsponsor des Fußballvereins Schalke 04.
In 2007, they entered into a sponsorship deal worth at least 25 million euros a year with the popular German club Schalke.
That sponsorship has really brought the attention of Gazprom to a wider German public.
And that deal had some additional benefits.
And of course, Germany is very dependent on gas imports coming from Russia.
Svi znate da je kompanija Gazprom visoko socijalno odgovorna kompanija koja mnogo ulaže u socijalne projekte.
And then in 2010, Gazprom became official sponsors of Serbian team Red Star Belgrade.
Vrlo, vrlo pamti, vrlo, vrlo cene. Bio godinama.
And this is where you notice a pattern, according to Szymanski. As he agreed to invest 3.8 million euros a year in Red Star, Gazprom also bought a controlling share of Serbia's state-owned oil company called NIS. They plan to develop a new pipeline called the South Stream that would push their business further into southern Europe.
Sokola, and he's in!
What a goal!
Sumptuous goal from Eden Hazard!
And then 2 years later, they became the energy sponsors for English Premier League champions Chelsea. That same year, in 2012, they became the official sponsors of the Champions League. But that was nothing compared to their next move. In 2013, Gazprom signed on to sponsor the governing body of international soccer itself, FIFA.
The
2018 FIFA World Cup, ladies and gentlemen, will be organized in Russia.
The next World Cup in 2018 is being held in Russia herself. According to Szymanski and other experts, it's hard not to draw correlations between Gazprom's soccer investments and their business interests around Europe and the world.
You can take my word for it. The 2018 World Cup in Russia will be up to the highest standards.
Putin sees soccer as part of his strategy. Obviously, with the 2018 World Cup being hosted in Russia, he wants to use soccer again as the world's most popular sport to project an image, a positive and friendly image to the world. And the Gazprom sponsorship of soccer is part of that process.
But off the soccer field, the company is engaged in a more controversial competition. Again, here's Greenpeace's Ben Aliff.
Gazprom, with the backing of the Russian government, are looking to find new sources of energy. And one of their big focuses is in the Arctic, where they think that they will be able to find an awful lot of oil that they will then be able to sell on to Western markets. So the Arctic is a big focus for them.
Gazprom have already started exploratory drilling in the Arctic region of Russia. And in May, they even recently delivered its first shipment of offshore oil to the Netherlands.
The Arctic is melting at unprecedented rates, and this is because of global climate change. So Gazprom is racing into the Arctic to drill for more of the oil that's causing the region to melt in the first place.
Aliff says an oil spill in the Arctic would be catastrophic for the habitat and wildlife. To draw attention to this issue, Greenpeace has staged protests at some soccer games, including this one, at a Schalke game in 2013.
Greenpeace, the activist.
In the video, a couple of activists wearing harnesses drop from the roof of the stadium in the middle of the match. They slowly unveil a huge yellow banner that reads, Gazprom, don't foul the Arctic.
Konstruktion wurde da dieses riesige Banner entrollt. Auf dem Transparent wurde gegen den russischen UEFA und Schalke-Sponsor Gazprom protestiert wegen dessen oder gegen dessen Ego.
With Russia set to host the next World Cup, Gazprom is expected to take center stage. This is perhaps Gazprom's largest platform ever in terms of getting its message to a worldwide audience. And it's not just Gazprom using this kind of sports-driven marketing strategy. Again, here's Stefan Szymanski.
I think it's very striking that we've seen, at the same time as we've seen Russian oil and gas interests investing heavily in soccer, we've seen Gulf oil and gas interests investing heavily in soccer. So Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain, and a number of others, really, a number of other investments by Gulf oil interests taken place in recent years.
Other sports have their share of fossil fuel financing too, including many in the United States. For instance, Shell Oil sponsors Formula One racing and events on the PGA Tour. British Petroleum, BP, sponsors the British Olympic Association, the British Paralympic Association, and the US Olympic Committee. ExxonMobil.
So I think that's a trend that will continue because, it's a very good way to get your case in front of the American people, through the ownership of a franchise and being able to have some kind of platform to speak. So I do think we'll see more of it in the years to come.
It's plain to see some companies see these as important investments. For instance, with Gazprom, they've not only invested hundreds of millions of dollars into soccer, but they've coordinated these investments with their expansion efforts across Europe.
Giovanni! Giovanni! Dolce the River goal!
For soccer fans like me, all this might fade into the background. An oil company logo on a shirt, a stadium named after a gas giant. But we should take note, for these companies, the beautiful game is a serious business. For Making Contact, I'm Alex Lewis.
Spins it back.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. If you want more information about any of the stories you've heard on this show, go to radioproject.org. That's also where you can download our podcast or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, Andrew Stelzer, Jasmine Lopez, Laura Flynn, Quan Booth, and Barbara Barnett. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.